Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now, Posner versus Scalia and Posner versus Posner. Judge Richard Posner is with us. He's one of America's leading public intellectuals, especially with regard to the law. And he sits on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Appeals Court in Chicago. In his new book, Reflections on Judging, Posner challenges the style of judging that he calls formalism, best exemplified by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. He takes on Scalia on decisions including D.C. versus Heller, the one that curiously affirmed an individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment as if the militia clause didn't exist. But Posner himself has been making news lately for saying in some interviews for this book that he wrongly decided a voter ID case in 2007 because he didn't realize at the time how the law was intended to be a form of voter suppression. Oh, the blowback he's been getting for the sin of changing his mind. Let's talk about his mind and his book. Judge Posner, it's a real honor. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure.
And we'll get to your evolution on voter ID. But let's start with Posner versus Scalia. You call him a formalist and yourself a realist. What do those terms mean to a layperson?
Oh, I think the formalist judge is someone who wants to engage in basically a semantic approach to judging, where he looks at, you know, the authoritative legal source like the Constitution or a statute and ask, you know, what do these words mean? What does the dictionary say they mean? And I prefer a purpose of interpretation where you ask, you know, what do you think the authors of this statute, this constitutional provision, were trying to accomplish, given, you know, modern conditions different from when they drafted it, and, you know, what's a reasonable result given what we know of their intentions, but also the considering the practicalities, modern needs, and so on.
Conditions today. But realism, though it's a friendly-sounding word, better than unrealism, but you refer to a critique of realism as substituting your personal beliefs and emotions for the objective interpretation of laws or the Constitution. Why is it not that?
That's certainly a danger because, you know, as soon as you start thinking about what's a reasonable result, what's consistent with current needs and so on, then your personal views are going to often play a role, no question about it. But that's also true with these semantic interpreters. their views, their personal views, influence how they approach this, you know, kind of semantic analysis, what they find in a dictionary.
By that, do you mean that you think someone like Scalia is fooling himself, thinking he's being neutral on the issues by just sticking to interpretation of the law, or is he trying to fool the public by being a conservative activist in constitutional scholars' clothing?
No, I don't think there's – I have no reason to think that he's hypocritical. I think he believes that he is engaged in a completely objective, politically neutral interpretation of the Constitution. But I think fooling oneself is a way to do it. I think when you look at the actual materials which formalist judges use, the interpretive materials and so on, you see that they don't really lead anywhere, and there must be something unconsciously pushing the judge in that direction. If you look at the gun case, the Heller case, Justice Scalia has a very elaborate historical exegesis going back to the Middle Ages about gun rights in England, and Justice Stevens dissenting has an equally complicated historical exegesis leading to the opposite conclusion. I don't think you can really say one of them is right and one of them is wrong. this historical stuff and dictionary is often indeterminate. So something else is pushing the decision. No matter what the justices think they're doing, maybe they think, each of them maybe thinks he's a really skilled historian and can figure out, you know, what the medieval view was and was it carried forward into the 18th century and all that. But I just don't think that that works.
So in that context, I really liked your takedown of Scalia's reasoning in the Heller decision, the Supreme Court ruling that affirmed the right to bear arms as an individual right, having nothing to do with a well-regulated militia. The issue is how to read a preamble, a
right.
well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That's the preamble. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So how do you and Scalia see that pesky preamble differently?
Well, one thing, I look back to the 18th century and to the fact, first of all, that the colonists and, you know, the new America that emerged from the Revolution, very suspicious of standing armies, very hostile, of course, to the British army for obvious reasons, and believing in the importance of a militia as opposed to a standing army. So a militia, you know, people who, they're just guys who have a musket at home and they're available for military service, don't have much in the way of training. And these people were required, the militia members, they were required to buy a gun and keep it in their house. It wasn't supplied to them by the government. So
there was actually a law, should we call it an individual mandate, for people to buy arms in the United States at one point, right?
Right. If you were, you know, able-bodied man, you were supposed to have, now you'd have probably have a musket anyway for hunting or because you were afraid of Indians, but you had to have it. You had to, you know, keep it in good condition and loaded and so on. And that's why in the Second Amendment, you have to have the right to keep and bear arms, because you can't, you wouldn't have a militia if the militia members weren't allowed to have a gun in their house. But the key phrase, as you suggested, the key thing is the preamble, which makes it clear that this right to bear arms is ancillary to the creation, the existence of the militia, which the federal government isn't permitted to.
So we've dropped the militia because now we have a standing army and kept the individual right to bear arms.
We have a militia in the sense we have a National Guard, which
right.
is success. But on the other hand, the members of the National Guard do not keep, you know, lethal weapons in their home. The weapons are in storage, obviously. So thing has changed, but the notion of a personal right to keep arms, that's very modern. And the other thing is that pistols were very rare in or quite rare in the 18th century.
Meaning handguns?
And so you wouldn't have people walking around carrying pistols.
Right, so, handguns. So by the same token, if formalists like Scalia read the Second Amendment so strictly in an individual sense, why don't they think we have a right to bear nuclear weapons or fully automatic machine guns?
Well, that's, of course, a criticism that he's made because, for example, he acknowledges in his opinion that there are a lot of appropriate restrictions on personal gun ownership, such as, you know, insanity or having a criminal record. But there's no indication that there were rules of that sort in the 18th century. So, but that means he's willing to acknowledge the relevance of modern concerns. Not all the way, not to allowing, you know, Washington, D.C. actually to ban personal ownership of guns. But he is willing to, you know, acknowledge various limitations, and one of them is on weapons that are, you know, military weapons.
My guest on WNYC is the legendary judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Court of Appeals in Chicago, and public intellectual Richard Posner. His new book is called Reflections on Judging. And, all right, voter ID. You've really gotten yourself in some soup with this one. When I Googled you this morning, not knowing anything about this controversy, that was 7 of the first 8 things that came up. You did get one book review in there, but 7 of the 8 were about this thing that you said recently where you ruled in favor of Indiana's voter ID law in 2007, and now you conclude that you decided it wrongly. Do I have that accurately?
No, not exactly. What I said in my book, it's just like one sentence, is that judges, I mean, this is really a basic theme of the book, judges are handicapped by limited knowledge of the sort of real-world context in which they decide cases. And one of the areas of ignorance for many judges, including myself, are the electoral process. I've never been involved in politics, so I don't know anything about it. So in this case we had involving Indiana photo ID for voters, and I went back and looked at my opinion. I said, look, there are two competing concerns. One is there's a concern with voter fraud, so you want to have, you know, a reliable identification to make sure someone who comes in to vote is eligible. On the other hand, there's the concern that overly, you know, strict demanding photo ID voter laws disenfranchise people, especially, you know, people who maybe they don't have a car, they can't go to the place, you know, they don't have a drive. If you have a driver's license, you have your photo ID. If you don't have a driver's license, what are you supposed to do? You have to drive to some place and get a, or you can't drive, you don't have a car. You have to go somewhere, get a photo. So what we said in the opinion was, you know, it's a balance. It's the fraud concern versus the disenfranchisement concern. And we said, well, you know, we don't want to micromanage a voter law by state, so we'll uphold the Indiana law. And the Supreme Court affirmed. In fact, Justice Stevens, who's liberal justice, he wrote the opinion that affirmed our decision. What I said in the book is that since then, since I think it was 2006, he said 2007, maybe it's one of the 2 years. Since then, we've had a lot of these voter ID laws, and there's a lot of belief out there that really the purpose is disenfranchisement, and it's not to correct fraud.
And we're going to run out of time soon, but so being educated with the, you know, advantage of experience now, you would make a different ruling in that case?
Well, not necessarily, because I'm dubious now about the reasons that the states give for these laws. I mean, I'm suspicious because of what we've learned in the last 7
right.
years.
And I'll just say that much of the blowback, and there's another one in the Washington Post just today, is about the appropriateness of you as a sitting federal judge saying this publicly at all. The argument is this crosses the line set by the official code of conduct for United States judges not to reflect adversely on your impartiality on a subject that could come before you again. I guess this is why Supreme Court justice nominees always refuse to say what they think about Roe versus Wade.
I think it's complete nonsense because, I mean, judges are public officials and they should be transparent, I think.
So when the next nominee comes before the Senate and somebody asks, well, do you think Roe versus Wade was rightly decided? Should they just say yes or no?
I think that's an appropriate question. What is a problem? I don't think you want to give a judge a case that hasn't been decided and say, how would you decide that? Because then the judge is on record, and however he votes in that case, people think, well, you know, he's voting that way because he said he would, or he's not voting that way because he doesn't want to be accused of having prejudged the case. So that's why I'm not going to say that, and it's not true that I know how I'm going to decide the next voter ID case, right? Because there are a lot of considerations that a judge is going to weigh. But I've obviously I've written
lots of books.
I've written more than 2,900 published judicial opinions.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are some of them are wrong. I mean, they have to be. Judging isn't that kind of, you know, it's not science, and it's very difficult to get everything right, and nobody does. And how could that be? Why should that be concealed?
And on that note, rare, you know, introspection, and I might get things wrong. Politicians don't come on the show and say, "Well, maybe I got something wrong." I wish we had more time to talk about some of the interesting things you write about the law itself. Like, it's not art, it's not science, it's what? It's service. And the law attracts some very bright people, but it's not profound. I wish we had more time to explore those. So maybe in another conversation.
Okay.
And I've really enjoyed this one.
Thanks. I enjoyed talking to you.
I'll keep following your work with great interest, and I'm glad our listeners got to hear you talk at some length today. Judge Richard Posner, his new book is Reflections on Judging. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.